I'm Tom Slaw, the Executive Director of TSIA. Welcome to Tectonic, the podcast where we explore what makes technology business models successful in today's world. Today, we are diving into the most critical business challenge of the decade, AI economics. This isn't about the technology of AI. It's about the financial and organizational shockwave that AI is sending through every B2B tech company. The old rules are collapsing. Per-user pricing is now a liability. Organizational silos are a bug, not a feature. And the market is demanding technology providers deliver quantifiable value, not just features. To dissect this unprecedented moment, I am joined by two of my esteemed colleagues, JB Wood, the CEO of TSIA, and George Humphrey, the SVP of Research. Today, we are going to play an insightful game. I'm going to read the headlines from recent news articles, headlines about massive job cuts, pricing chaos, and the rise of AI agents. And together, we are going to analyze through the lens of AI economics what we believe you should really be taking away from that headline. So let's get the insight engine humming. Gentlemen, welcome. This, I think, is going to be a fun conversation. But before we get into it, JB, could you just help the audience understand? We have this concept out there called AI economics. Just an overview of what we mean by that.
Well, you just described it pretty well. The technology is pretty cool and the business model ain't. Look, this is one of those really disruptive waves, and there have only been a few of them over the last 30 or 40 years that has the potential to get enterprise customers in particular to just sort of throw out a lot of their existing IT infrastructure and spending and all that kind of stuff and retool the business around this technology. And so we know there's going to be a lot of revenue there. There's no doubt about it. But how you extract profit in this model is super unclear. I mean, and not only that, but how does it change the way enterprise tech companies need to do business? And, you know, we are starting to see patterns, and that's what AI economics is about, is what do we think the patterns of success and the patterns of failure that are emerging are, and what does it mean to not only the startups who are trying to get in there and eat away at the market share of all the large incumbents who've owned the enterprise IT budget for years. But then how do these large incumbents defend, protect, grow, take advantage of this when they're under pressure at the same time to be profitable each and every quarter? And so it really is about accepting that the tech is cool and disruptive and moving to the next thought in the food chain, which is, okay, how do I be in this business in a way that gets me the growth I see and I want, but it allows me to take down that revenue in a profitable model?
Yep. So I'm going to pull headlines, and these are real world headlines. I'm going to make these up that have occurred in the last 12 to 24 months. And we're going to put this AI economics lens on these headlines and help people understand, you know, our thinking and why this is important. And the first one I want to start out with is one that really rocked the world of a lot of our member companies when it came out a couple of months ago. And here's the headline. Salesforce CEO confirms 4,000 job cuts because I need less heads with AI. And we know in that article, those job cuts, you know, reported to be mostly customer support oriented people. So JB, you know, that headline comes out. I'm going to start with you. What do you think our audience needs to understand about what's really going on there?
That it's the easy half of the thought. I mean, is AI going to displace the need for a lot of job roles and tech support or, you know, other parts of the business? Absolutely. Absolutely. And we're a huge believer in the fact that you got to onboard that. You know, if you're running those kinds of organizations, if you can create a better customer experience with less heads, you owe it to everybody to go do that. Mm-hmm. So the idea that he was able to take these 4,000 people out of support because he didn't need them anymore, that was fodder for every CFO, every, you know, CEO, everybody in the world who said, oh my God, look at all these heads I'm going to be able to get rid of.
Yep.
That is the easy obligatory part. The question is, what do you do with that money? How do you reinvest that money to get yourself ready for the age of AI? And in that particular case, he said, and so I can go hire 4,000 salespeople or something to that effect. Yep. And that's what I disagree with violently. Like, of all the things I could have picked to redeploy that capital into would not have been that many more salespeople. And, you know, Mark and I could debate that until the cows come home. But yeah, no, I think it's an absolutely valid half of a sentence. Yep. I was able to do this and I saved a lot of money. And that allowed me to go do X. And that's question of what do you do with X and how does that lead to a profitable AI first business model? That's the debate. And that article didn't cover a lot of that, by the way.
No, it didn't. And, you know, we watched that headline unfold within our members. And again, it did send sort of a shockwave. We had one of our members on our advisory board say that, you know, the weekend that came out, you know, came out on a Friday and they got a call over the weekend saying, well, when are we going to go do that, you know, right, in our support organization? But to your point, what's happened since that headline is we know that Salesforce is going out and now doing some massive hiring for forward deployed engineers, right? As another example, right? So it has to be both thoughts. You know, there are going to be savings with a lot of traditional workflows and some headcount there, but there's also going to be new needs that have to be covered as well. And what do those look like? So I think that's the really important thing there. It's two parts of the equation. One of the things that you talked about, the AI economics that we focus on, is this battle between incumbents and new entrants. So there's another headline here, and I want to throw this one over to you, George, that caught my eye. And here's the headline. Analyst downgrades Adobe stock, citing risk from generative AI competitors. What should people understand about that?
Well, so for sure, the threat's real. But, you know, Adobe's moat, let's talk about photo editing, for example. Maybe we can go to document management next. It was really rooted in complexity. Uh-huh. That's where they could command a premium for their pricing. And now with all of the image generation capabilities out there that also have editing functions built into them, built right directly into the model that you're already using, look at Nano Banana Pro. Uh-huh. Gemini 3, you can do a lot more advanced capabilities for a lot less money. And so that really does disrupt when these models start to eat the software vendors. I think that's where it becomes really disruptive to the market.
I think there's such an incredible imagery in the idea that these, you know, ChatGPT and everything else, right? So their whole UX UI is one prompt line. You know, if you look at it, it's all blank screen. There's one prompt line and nobody really knows what's behind it, including the incumbents who worry that behind it is some features and functionality that could disrupt them, right? And they don't know. And, you know, what's behind that prompt line is changing all the time. It is massive investment and you don't know who that investment is aimed at disrupting. And it's just such a great imagery to me that there is this big opaque field and everybody's worried about what's behind, you know.
And when these new features get unveiled, I mean, you know, because Adobe's not, you know, unique here. There was a headline just a couple weeks ago about related to document management. So I think ChatGPT came out with some new, you know, document management capabilities, and the day they announced that, DocuSign's stock price immediately took a hit. And so it's to your point, JP, suddenly behind that black box, this new feature gets unveiled and it's like, whoa, that's cutting into somebody's business model and it's going to move, you know, super fast.
So yeah, and the barrier to entry has just been obliterated by these tools.
Yeah, for sure. And again, back to, you know, why we are selling AI economics is how, you know, that tension, that battle between the incumbents and what they can do to protect, you know, their markets versus how these AI startups are going to come at it is something that we've got a big research bright light on. And JB, I'll throw this one to you. It's about the size of the opportunity here and a reason that people are, you know, very excited about the current moment in tech, because people just see, you know, just massive markets. And so there's this headline here, agentic AI systems market is projected to exceed $10 billion by 2026. So what did people need to understand about that?
Way too small. Seriously.
Yeah.
Way too small.
Yeah.
I'll bet you the exit rate around, you know, and again, agentic AI is, you know, that's what has got everybody's attention right now. Who knows what has everybody's attention, you know, 12 months from today, right? Mm-hmm. But spending on those kinds of capabilities, I mean, I would predict an exit rate that is 5 to 10 times that. And, and that's the other important point was, you know, again, if you think about sort of the crossing the chasm model and the idea that, you know, some disruptive new technology comes along and you have these sort of innovators and early adopters that are doing these trial projects and so forth and so on. And really what rightly you should worry most about is those big majority sectors, right? Where all the huge enterprises who maybe aren't these early bleeding edge adopters mm-hmm. are going to come in and spend the big money.
Yeah.
Well, it used to be that for technology to complete that journey, I mean, it might be a decade, right? Mm-hmm. This is moving super compressed.
Yeah.
Super compressed. And so it is not a matter of like, if you are hesitating and you're saying, well, I've probably got the next 3 or 4 years to kind of figure this out, you're toast. So I think it's way too small a number. I think the spend is going to increase exponentially. And I just don't think that these incumbents in particular, you know, it's really a race between whether the startups can get scale before the incumbents repurpose the scale they have intelligently. That's what we see as the race in a nutshell, right? And the incumbents are out of the blocks, man. They are hauling butt to try to build scale in, again, these sort of different ways that the incumbents have built themselves. And the incumbents maybe are smart enough to say, I got to take this scale and retool it, repurpose it, redeploy it, reaccount for it, mm-hmm. right? Or they're saying, manana. And, you know, that's the race.
I want to loop this question, though, back over to, you know, JB's response in the first question and the conversation we just had about Adobe. So I'll make a bold prediction that there's not a job out there in enterprise tech that isn't going to be using agentified AI to some extent. So if I loop it back to Salesforce.com, how were they able to reduce 4,000 support engineers? Because they're employing agents into the support workforce. How are we able to overcome the cost barriers of Adobe? It's because we're using agents for image creation now. So I think if you think about it that way, and all of the use cases that agents can be used for, I think the numbers become enormous.
Yeah, and I think, you know, JB, what you're saying about how big this market is, and George, you're, you know, amplifying that comment. I think the speed is what's so important here. I think, you know, JB, George, we've watched a lot of technology companies sort of slow roll their transformation from, you know, on-premise to as a service. And they took years and years and years to kind of do that and drag their heels because they didn't want to disrupt their super lucrative, you know, on-premise model. But I think that when I read this headline, and the opportunity is so massive. And what you said, JB, it's not going to take like 10 years for this market to mature. It's happening at, you know, warp speed. That if you're an incumbent, you can't sit there and slow roll this. You can't sit there and go, I'm just going to hold on to my, you know, my current market and my current world, and I'll take my time here. That's the surefire way to get blown out of the water here. Just no doubt.
You know, prior to TSIA, I had responsibility for helping drive from on-prem to cloud our whole portfolio of products. And it was growing so fast and so successful at one point that the CFO said, hey, you guys got to stop. You're cannibalizing our existing on-prem revenue streams with these services revenues. And I said, half tongue in cheek, well, wouldn't you rather we eat our own children than someone else eating our children? And I don't think he thought it was very funny, but I guess who has the last laugh after two bankruptcies for that company that was number one market share leader in every segment they were in? The threat's real, only the times, to your point, are way more compressed. So the dilemma of the incumbents is eat or be eaten.
For sure. The economics of enterprise tech are breaking. AI startups are threatening the domain of long-established enterprise technology providers. Yet, it is unclear exactly how technology providers will drive profitable revenue in the AI era. TSIA has always been focused on what it takes to have a profitable business model in enterprise tech. AI Economics is a body of actionable TSIA research that is digging into the future of tech business models. How will AI solutions be priced? What does the next generation tech services portfolio look like? And why does TSI believe that it is not the end of tech services, but the era of services? Go to tsi.com/AI economics to learn the answers. So the next headline I'm going to draw on here is focused on another thread we have in AI economics, which is around pricing. Because we believe that specifically for enterprise AI, If you're a provider there, you've got to get the pricing model right to keep margin and profitability on the table. And so here's the headline. Venture capitalists begin demanding outcome-based pricing models for new portfolio companies. So, George, I'll ask you, what does that headline tell you?
Yeah. I mean, so the headline tells me that the VC, the people with funding for the next round of innovation, they already know that SaaS is on a death spiral, that the per user pricing is shrinking in a world that's, again, pick on Salesforce. So if ServiceNow sells IT service management software to Salesforce and they need 4,000 less seats for that ITSM, that's a big problem. Now, if ServiceNow turns around and creates an innovative capability in their platform that empowers customer success people to look at operations data to make data-driven recommendations for the customer, do this, not that, then that increases value in a new way. And so it's really about the outcome. It gets back to this outcome-based pricing. We started talking about this in 2016 with the industry, and we're finally at a place now where AI and data analytics, data science can absolutely predict outcomes. And so we are seeing the venture capital funds flow into the organizations that take a service-centric approach to diagnose a customer's problems and then to provide a solution that they know can move those metrics.
And if you stand back far enough, this is a repeating theme in the history of Silicon Valley. But this idea that a technology comes along and it produces more value for customers with less revenue for the supplier is a super scary place for a company who has been making revenue in an old way. You know, the capabilities of AI, this is not just a software story. With software, it's agents. Like, you know, I'm going to sell somebody agents and they're going to be able to take 4,000 heads out. Well, if I was doing human-based seat licensing model, I just helped them save whatever that is, $400 million. And my license count on the renewal just went down by whatever it is, right? So nobody is going to stand around and say, I can continue to deliver more and more and more and more value to my customers and not try to take some of that value off the table as revenue. Yeah. They've got to. And again, that notion of how long before I'm willing to move off this model, again, in SaaS, you know, that is the dominant model, you know, all of software, right? It's per seat license, right? But it, as I said, it's not just a software story. You know, if I've got a piece of hardware or a piece of industrial equipment that's robotic and, you know, so forth, and the capability that I'm building in the new units is more than three or four of the old units. And so the customer doesn't have to replace three or four with three or four or five. They can replace three or four with one and get the same production output, right? So this notion of how do I capture the incremental value that I'm creating with the solutions I'm delivering to customers via my pricing model is a super fundamental, important question in the area of AI economics.
For sure. And I want to follow that up with another headline, because again, we've got a bright light on pricing and where we think this is going to go. And this next headline here says that OpenAI considers usage-based pricing after admitting cost challenges with their $200 a month pro subscription. So they had, you know, JB, you know, a user-based pricing model. They're saying, hey, that's not working for us. We want to go to usage-based. But, you know, we think there's kind of hair on that as well. So what's your perspective in terms of them just trying to take that next slick over?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, consumption-based pricing seems to be to people, as you said, the next click over. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that they're approaching it, you know, and I think that this headline is a great example, by looking at their costs and saying the cost of delivering that $200 a month license, just the raw compute and storage and, you know, all that kind of stuff is more than $200 for my aggressive users. And so, you know, I've got to pass on more of that cost to those people who are consuming more. And yeah, that is a step, I would argue, in the right direction, but it is ignoring this value capture calculation that we just talked about. It's a cost plus thing. And, you know, I don't think any of us believe that's the ultimate destination, right? You still aren't linking to the value creation. And so I think there's going to be, you know, when we talk about this in our work, there's going to be these more advanced models than just cost plus consumption-based pricing, which I think is a lot of people were thinking that's like, that's their next step in the journey. And it's, yeah. it's even that is not going to last long.
We know from talking to members that, and this started at least a year and a half ago, this sense of urgency of I've got to go to some type of usage or consumption-based pricing. We started to hear that very loud as soon as the reality that AI was going to probably start to level out headcount growth, et cetera. But all of us here on this podcast today have come to the conclusion that that is just not going to be the end game. It's just not going to keep enough margin and profitability on the table, which goes back to the previous headline. Now, you know, I think the VCs are waking up to that as well. And that's why they're telling their startups, let's talk about outcomes, man. Let's get on, you know, let's get to that higher grounds. We have a business model that's going to be profitable here. I'm going to shift to another area that we were focused on under AI economics, which is really sort of how these org structure models are going to change. Because we do believe that AI is going to sort of rock the world of our traditional tech org models. And George, I'm going to throw this one to you. Here's the headline. Microsoft unifies sales and customer success teams to accelerate, you know, Copilot or AI adoption. What should people be thinking about that when we see headlines? And they're not the only ones who are smashing stuff together. I mean, Salesforce smashed support and customer success together, you know, about a year ago. What should people understand about this?
You know, we talked about this at the Envision conference, but the first big takeaway is today's organizational models that tech companies have been used to for the past several decades, 30 plus years, are unsustainable in the new world. And it's all about value creation, time to value earlier on in the engagement with the customer. And you have to deeply understand your customer to do so. The traditional salesperson that sells on feature functionality really isn't going to cut it. It's also why so many organizations, like you talked about, are leaning into the FDE mob. So how do we get to understand our customer better, better maybe than they even understand themselves? How do we diagnose them? How do we prescribe what it is they actually need before we talk about the first widget that we want to sell them? And so that really requires a much more consultative-led approach early on. And then as you move into your day two operations, it's really about how do you continue to extract value out of that operation. We would have classically thrown that over the fence from sales to the professional services team, from professional services to the operations team, from the operations team to the success team. And again, that kind of journey is going to break down really quickly for customers with these models. So it's why you have to do these design services up front. It's why you have to optimize the models as you go on and ideally have them all aligned around the outcome. That's a heavy value engineering function that's needed up front and then a set of resources that's optimized around the delivery of that outcome that you promised the customer you could deliver.
Yeah, this is the argument I said in the very beginning that, you know, I could argue with Mark about the second half of his sentence, right? I let 4,000 people go in support so I could add 4,000 people in sales. And I'm sure at the time, you know, because Agentforce was such a buzzy, hot thing that I think he literally thought some version of, I need more people who can take orders. And that is not turning out to be the issue, right? This whole definition of what does the pre-sales motion look like? And who's involved in the pre-sales motion? What kind of skills are involved? What is billable? What is not in these early motions? To George's point, who has a responsibility? Because revenue increases at that customer are going to be generated by more and more and more value capture. And so the growth of these accounts, it used to be, geez, do I have enough salespeople to land them and then to expand them, right? And now it's going to be, I am putting all this money and time and effort into taking the technology and designing and activating value. Then I need the scalable capability to help them really realize and expand that value. And that's how I get more revenue, right? Mm-hmm. Do you hear a salesperson in any of that?
Right.
I mean, and so my argument with Mark, and I think subsequent to that headline, you see what they're doing. They are hiring more of these FDEs. They are thinking about, you know, what is the definition of customer success in an environment like the one I just described? And so the tricky part is, what do I do with the savings from the low-hanging fruit that I use agentic AI to, you know, reduce headcount? How do I reinvest? And I also use the word account. How do I account for that?
Yeah.
Right? Am I willing, and back to what did we see during SaaS, am I willing to go back to a day when my cost of sales are 150% of my revenue? Because that could happen. That could absolutely happen. If I have to throw all these resources into pre-sales and not be able to bill for it, my cost of sales could skyrocket.
Yeah.
And I can guarantee you that's what's happening at some of these startup AI companies. And, you know, nobody cares because they can't raise money fast enough. But we have a new version of that problem, right? That was a sales rep army problem. This is a technical pre-sales value engineering. It's a whole new layer of cost into the pre-sales model. And again, how does an incumbent who is trotting along happily at 24% or 26% cost of sales, or maybe even cost of sales and marketing, how are they going to pivot over to a cost of sales that's two times that or two and a half times that? Or
yeah,
the cost of sale could be two to three times higher if you monetize that cost of sale as a value offering. So, you know, we did this paper a year and a half ago, The Four Pillars of Professional Services, and we talked about consultation, design, implementation, and integration. Those are the four pillars. But every product company, exaggerating to make a point, gives away the consultation and the design. Right. So sales sells something, but it's really maybe the PS organization that does the heavy consulting, that understands what the right solution is and then designs it and implements it. And those companies are only monetizing the implementation typically as a percentage of the product. And so they're giving away the most valuable part. So they have to break that habit of undervaluing the most valuable part of a professional services engagement. That's why with OpenAI, why they won't take a consulting deal that's less than $10 million, because they know that there's incredible value there. Palantir does the same thing. A company called Provectus does the same thing. So it's all about a change in your mindset of where the value is in the solution you deliver.
That's a tough habit to break for a lot of companies.
Big time.
Well, I mean, there's several AI economic threads that are in play now here just under this one headline, right? So, you know, when I read that and as I listen to you two, so one of them is, you know, if you're sitting there and you think you're going to have the same org structure you've always had for the last 40 years in tech, we believe that's just not going to be true. It's got to become more fluid. Why? Because JB, as you were on, there's a lot more early work that has to be done to understand the customer, to unlock the value, et cetera. So that's a really important thread in terms of what are these new roles and work models going to look like so that they are super effective and efficient at identifying and sticking the landing on value, which historically, you know, we were kind of okay at doing that in tech. We got to be world-class at that. And then what you're on, George, as we're re-swizzling this, what do you monetize and what do you not monetize? That's another really super important thread, because if you just, you know, like you said, JB, it's a hard habit to break, but if you're just giving away all the stuff that you considered as pre-sales, consulting, or whatever, really expensive people, huge high-value capabilities you're putting on the table to help the customer, does that really make sense? And will that result in a profitable business model? You know, we don't think so. So there's a lot under there. Every Tectonic listener is well aware I am a big believer that AI is a game changer for how professionals in the technology industry will do their jobs. TSI Research is not immune to that reality. I am proud to say that we have been aggressively experimenting on how AI can change the way we create research and deliver those research insights to our members. And now we are ready to release TSIA Intelligence, the first Gen AI model designed exclusively for technology services. Unlike generic Gen AI tools, TSIA Intelligence taps into our real-world, industry-validated data that is not in the public domain. We have designed this model to give you clear, actionable, and board-ready insights. Right now, in technology services, the stakes are really high. Every decision counts. Good decisions can build your career. Bad ones can end it. General LLMs are incredibly powerful, but you need specialized insights built on industry data that you can trust. That is TSI Intelligence. To check it out, visit tsi.com/intelligence. And there's another headline that's kind of related to this on the org structure, which I think is both potentially inspiring and terrifying for service leaders. So this actually comes from ServiceNow's CEO, who we know well at TSIA. And basically, he said, AI adoption requires customer success to be retooled as a strategic consulting function. So JB, I'll start. What does that mean to you when you see that headline?
Well, it's back to this issue of what is the new version of account expansion?
Mm-hmm.
And is it simply a salesperson calling on a different part of the company to sell them the same thing that they already sold to that division over there? It is about increasing value capture and monetizing that. And mm-hmm. and then you say, okay, so again, who is best positioned to go do that? And one of the things that is, again, funny but familiar is everybody's on this thread of FTEs, right? Mm-hmm. Just like everybody used to be on this thread of data scientists, and everybody before that used to be on this thread of solution architects, right? And they're unicorns. You know, mm-hmm. there aren't a ton of them. And everybody's looking to hire them. It's the hottest job in enterprise tech right now. And so it's going to be very, very, very hard to scale that function. And if you define scaling as I need more and more and more and more and more of that skill set because there just aren't that many people, it's super competitive, blah, 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 blah. So then you say, okay, if I had to go to something else, what would that something else be? And I won't go into all of the alternatives, but certainly one of them is customer success.
Mm-hmm.
Because customer success, it is built to provide scale much more so than a Salesforce or a solutions architect or, you know, whatever. There is typically an amount of account knowledge that's embedded in the customer success function. There's some amount of technical awareness in a lot of those people in those roles. And while they may not be in there doing the vibe coding to get the customer to the next level of value, they might be spotting the opportunities. They may be quarterbacking other parts of the organization to engage. And so, but it ain't your grandpa's customer success organization.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And, you know, when you're talking there, George, it reminds me of the research that we're doing across all our practices around what services did we used to do in customer success or PS or whatever, and what's the future look like? And CS, I think, has a big migration in front of it, to your point, JB. It's like we're not kind of hand-holding on adoption and how do I use this feature, or I'm doing a quarterly QBR with the customer and just make sure that they're happy or whatever. I mean, it could be a massive pivot in terms of the strategic nature of the capability. But again, I think, you know, George, for a lot of our service leaders, that's terrifying.
Yeah, it is. I mean, so half of them still don't have a fully functioning customer success organization, and the other half that do are going to have to blow it up and rewrite it. Maybe blow it up's a little bit strong, but AI is causing massive changes in the skill profiles of the CSM. You know, moving away from being task managers, AI can eat that very effectively, to being data literate and AI literate, being trusted advisors, using things like insight operations out of the commercial systems, the external systems, the customer's operation systems, to be very prescriptive to the customer on where they need to go next. I mean, I'm extremely bullish on the expansion opportunities that AI brings to customer success organizations, but only if they lean in. It's going to change the processes. It's going to change the technologies that they use. Again, you call out ServiceNow for this one, but I'd like that they put their money where their mouth is with their impact organization and technologies that do exactly that. They drive insight ops for those success people, but it's a very different type of customer.
Well, once again, it isn't that the issue, right? So if I take, let's just take a CS function like onboarding. If I build an onboarding agent, it does a great job, and the CFO rolls in and says, hey, that's great. So we can take out 500 people because, you know, you're no longer having to require human-based onboarding. And there goes that budget, right, out of the CS function, because the CS leader was not in a position to explain competently to the financial voices of the company, yeah, that's great. We took 500 people out of that mundane task because in the new iteration of customer success, I need these skills. I need these kinds of people. I need these technologies. And that is going to allow me to fund a chunk of all that reinvestment. But if the CS leader can't articulate that, and that budget leaves the CS, you know, world and goes, whatever, to EPS or goes to sales, or whatever, that company is just going to be dead.
It's going to create an AI ops deficiency in that organization.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it is incumbent upon particularly the services executives, where I think a lot of this is going to fall. We say it's not the end of services, it's the era of services. And it is the ability of those service executives or the ones that replace them to help the company understand where the new investments need to be made to scale their AI capabilities and so forth. And if the services leader, you know, I said intentionally that person or the next person in the chair, because either they can do it, in which case they recapture and redeploy all of that capital from the labor takeout. They start getting much more actively involved in the expansion of accounts. They start bringing the decades of resource management and revenue generation of the service motions of the past, learning how to price and sell and renew service motions. And they start to bring that wisdom into this services-led AI world. I mean, there's all these things that we believe are required for profitable AI that are really related to the services side of the house. But if those leaders can't help educate internally what and why, they're doing a massive disservice to their shareholders and their customers.
For sure. For sure. Well, I'm keeping an eye on the clock here. I'm going to put one more headline on the table here for us to kick around. And this one relates to Palantir. And, you know, we have been pointing our member companies, who are basically software companies, SaaS companies, hardware companies, to look at Palantir as an example of a profitable business model in the world of AI. And what we notice is a lot of our members kind of resist this comparison because they're like, well, they're not really a product company. But we really believe that they represent a future state of what it means to be an enterprise tech provider. And the headline here says that Palantir reports significant growth in commercial revenue, right? So not government, commercial revenue, driven by its forward deployed engineer model. So I'll start with you, George. When you see that headline, and what thoughts do you have around Palantir and what they're doing right now?
Yeah, so they are the leader in the AI 20 index that we recently launched. They're a leader for a reason. They don't come with the past baggage of here's my product and my product revenue, and here's my service and here's my service revenue. And inside services, I've got these silos, and each one's got to get their margin and each one's got to get their revenue. They don't care. They're unencumbered by that. They have a professional services arm that is heavily charged by these FDEs that go in and discover and define and then have the ability to defend the value. They're heavily focused on the outcome. That's what they start with, is the outcome, and they engineer everything after that. They engineer the right product implementations and the integrations and the ongoing operations and the optimization. So I think that's really the key takeaway, is they have really reinvented what it is to be, quote, a solution provider. It's a service-led, product-powered solution.
Yep. JB, what are your thoughts when you see this headline?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, everything that George said, and they aren't afraid to monetize.
Correct.
They are not afraid to monetize. They are not afraid to charge for the outcomes and say, I want a piece of that. They're not afraid to. And they, you know, again, they're super opaque in their financial reporting, right? And so forth. But really, they are trying to take down revenue sort of all the way up and down the value chain. And they're doing it successfully. I mean, they're licensing, you know, there was a headline about the deal between Accenture and Palantir, I think, or Anthropic, right?
Anthropic.
And so there is a level of straight technology monetization that's still there. Mm-hmm. But if you look at a Palantir is saying, well, wait a minute. You know, really, it is this blend, as George was saying, of the services and the technology that go together. That's how we deliver the outcomes. We don't say we're going to give away one to get the other. We just put it together and we monetize the bloody heck out of it from day one, you know, throughout this entire value creation lifecycle with these customers, which, by the way, you do it right, never ends.
That's right.
Never ends. And you literally change the way. And I think this is the thing that should scare the crap out of it. You change the way customers want to consume tech companies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's one of the big lessons with Palantir. And again, they've got a high growth rate. They've got a high operating income. They've got an insane multiplier. Their valuation was about 100 times annual revenues, you know, 2 months ago. That's much higher than we've ever seen on a typical product company. And so I think they really do represent where things are going to go. What you just said, JP, how do enterprise companies want to consume technology? They want to consume it that way. Give me the value. I'm willing to pay for it, but you got to give me the value and not be, you know, afraid of stepping up to do that. So, well, folks, I enjoy you guys coming in and talking about these headlines. Again, I mean, this stuff's moving super fast here, but there's a lot of threads that are in play that we're very focused on with this research, because as we've said in this conversation, this is not going to take 5 or 8 or 10 years to unfold. This is moving super fast. And so my question of the day for the audience, are you in the process of mastering AI economics? Cheers, everybody. One of the main reasons we founded TSIA almost 20 years ago was to establish accurate operational benchmarks for technology service businesses that just didn't exist anywhere. Benchmarking is a killer tool to quickly understand your strengths and weaknesses. Benchmarking sets you on a journey that starts with where you are, points to what is possible, and identifies the business practices that will get you there. That's why I am super excited we decided to offer a free version of TSIA's industry-leading benchmarks with Performance Optimizer. Performance Optimizer is an easy-to-use benchmarking tool you can access from the TSIA website. You can assess operational strengths and weaknesses in multiple areas like customer success, professional services, support services, etc. And the Optimizer results prescribe specific actions to address specific challenges and opportunities. This is an amazing offer, and I am so proud we are doing this for all of our loyal Tectonic listeners who may not be corporate TSIA members. To check it out, visit tsia.com/free.